Hello, welcome to this episode of The Lancet Voice. I'm Jessamy Baganall, Senior Executive Editor at The Lancet, and I'm here with my co-host Gavin Teether. This week, we talk to the lead of The Lancet Standing Commission on Dementia Prevention, Intervention and Care, Professor Jill Livingstone, who is a Professor of Psychiatry of Older People at the Division of Psychiatry, the Faculty of Brain Sciences at University College London, and Geir Salbeck, who is a Research Director at the Norwegian National Advisory Unit on Aging and Health, and a professor at the Department of Geriatric Medicine, University of Oslo. They've just published an update on the Dementia Commission from 2024, and we were keen to hear all about it. A brief overview of their key messages. There are two new modifiable risk factors for dementia. New evidence supports adding vision impairment and high cholesterol as potentially modifiable risk factors for dementia to add to the 12 risk factors identified in the 2020 Lancet Commission. These are less education, head injury, physical inactivity, smoking, excessive alcohol consumption, hypertension, obesity, diabetes, hearing impairment, depression, infrequent social contact, and air pollution. 14 risk factors account for 49%, that's nearly half of the risk for dementia, and modifying them may prevent or delay dementia. The Commission covers specific actions to reduce dementia risk across the life course, like the importance of good quality education for all, and specific recommendations for those living with dementia. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Jill, Geir, thank you so much for joining us on the Lancet Voice podcast today. We're really excited to have the latest update of the Lancet Dementia Commission coming out. Perhaps we could start with just a kind of really broad overview. What are the main changes in this latest update? Because for listeners that aren't familiar, it's a standing commission that has regular updates.
So one is in prevention and risk reduction to reduce people's chance of ever developing dementia. The second is in detection and diagnosis of dementia, and particularly thinking about biomarkers. And the third is in treatment of dementia, which includes new drugs, but also more evidence about psychosocial interventions.
I would say that a big change this time was that it was more difficult, because in a way you could say that it has more has happened over the past 4 years in this field than during the previous 20 years. So when we're trying to reach consensus now, we have to, in a way, acknowledge that the field might be different tomorrow. And also, Jill talked about prevention. I think one big change is that we have a lot more knowledge about the interventions, because earlier we have been talking about associations. We say that, well, if you smoke, your risk going getting dementia increases. But this time, I think we have added a lot of information about that stopping smoking, for instance, or reducing air pollution, treating depression, treating hearing impairment or vision loss also works, which I think is great evidence or a great message to put through to the people.
The commission was one of the first big works to talk about prevention in dementia. So you say there's been lots of progress in the last 4 years versus the previous 20. Do you think there's a kind of bit of a virtuous circle about that? You know, you're kind of getting the word out of there about these are things you can do to prevent dementia, and then it's kind of following on from that?
What one of the members of the commission said is that you publish it and then the dementia community sort of says, go, we say, we know this, this is really good. And then the research community, but we don't know this. And the research community says, fantastic, we are going to try and find out. So I think that, I mean, the work is partly our work, but it's other people's work as well. And I not only give us huge information to help people and to think about policy and intervention, but it's really useful for the research community to as a marker of where we're at. And like Geir says, it's remarkably hopeful, because for the first time in many of these risk factors, we have more knowledge about interventions, and the interventions have done what we would expect to have happened. Decreasing excessive alcohol makes people less likely to get dementia. Decreases stopping smoking reduces the excess risk. treating high blood pressure reduces the excess risk. And all of these things are very important and really make a difference to individuals and society in the future.
No, I just would add that I think apart from informing the research environment, this commission is also read by policymakers and clinicians. So in a way, it sets the stage for what people think is the most important things. I think I was really surprised by how influential this commission was already in 2017. And I think this has only increased through the last commission and hopefully also by this new commission.
Yeah, thanks so much. I just wondered whether I might just ask, because obviously the risk factors are a really key thing for the commission, and they're what, you know, we all talk about and know. But for our listeners who might not be familiar with the commission, those risk factors and the associations, as you say, are obviously estimates. How do you find those risk factors? And to what degree can we have confidence in the sort of magnitude of the relationship between those risk factors and later dementia?
Can I start off with the magnitude? So the way we worked out the magnitude is we look at the worldwide relative risk of any risk factor, and we do that through systematic reviews. However, we know that that is, as you say, an estimate, and that's worldwide, and they do vary between countries. And equally, we've looked at the worldwide prevalence and incidence, and we use the best and most recent data available to try to do that. So we put these together, and then we estimate what we call the population attributable fraction. So how much difference it would make if you could get rid of the whole of the risk factor. And then we consider that people are not at all like laboratory mice, and they tend to have more than one thing wrong with them, and they cluster their risk factors. And so we look at a sample population, and we work out how much the risk factors cluster, and we modify the risk, decrease it, because the person who has high blood pressure is more likely to have diabetes, is more likely to be obese, is less likely to take physical activity, and we cluster them according to them. So that's how we work out the magnitude. So it's quite difficult, requires lots of time and lots of sums, and it's the best estimate available. But for individual countries, if, for example, people have more or less education, that would make a difference. And it changes within individual countries. And Gail will talk more about it in a minute. But for this time, last time we used British data to look at the overlap. But this time, and people having it this time, we used Norwegian data to look at the overlap. And it is very interesting to know how that varies between populations. We don't really know. We hope that we will find out in future, and have a look between all the different populations. But the Norwegian data, and our huge gratitude from the Hunt study to let us use it, is that had every single risk factor possible to derive or already in it. And that was amazing, because we couldn't find any other databases in the world that we didn't look at all of them, but we tried pretty hard and we couldn't find any others like that. But Gail can tell you more about that, because they came from he helped us get access to it.
Yeah, but first I wanted to add, because everybody's talking about the magnitude or the importance of these risk factors, and I looked at this figure, which has
a
really great impact. it's a bit scary, but it's a bit scary though, you know, because these are only estimates. And people say, oh, this is the magnitude of the risk. No, it's not the magnitude of the risk. It's the risk and the prevalence of this risk factor in the society. So when we have hearing impairment and now LDL cholesterol as the most, in a way, important risk factors, this is not about the magnitude of the risk. It's also about how common these risk factors are. And for the Hunt study, it was really great that we could use it. And I don't think they knew that when they did this in the 1990s, they, by coincidence, I would say, collected data on all the risk factors that would be included in the Lancet Commission in 2024. but that's how it is. But also, Jill was talking about how we define the magnitude. I think even more important is how we decide which risk factors to include. And a lot of people will say, wow, why is sleep omitted? Yeah. What about diet? Shouldn't that be in? So that is where Jill and her group do the great work, preparing all this, you know, evidence, presenting them to the members of the commission, and they have to fight about, is this evidence strong enough to be included among these 14 or 12 or whatever it will be next time?
Well, let's hear a bit more about that process. That sounds interesting. Jill, maybe you can, I don't know, maybe you could give us an example of something like sleep.
So we initially started off, we couldn't work out which ones to use, and we used ones in which were in the American policy and the British policy. So we just used these and we didn't answer. And then people kept saying, well, why do you not use whatever, sleep, diet? And so what we've done for the next two, so what we did for this one is I wrote to all the members of the commission, and we tried to get people from a very wide spectrum of the world. And we wrote to them and said, people are suggesting these risks. Is it reasonable that we talk about them? And are there any others we want to add? And then we had a list. And then we went through them at the commission. So like Gare said, myself, particularly Andrew Summerlad, Naheed McAdam, John Huntley, Kathy Liu, and Sergio Costa Frida, went through them and tried to find as much evidence as we possibly could, and then presented it to people within the commission, and we discussed them, and we discussed, and you at the end of it came to a conclusion. Did it fulfill the criteria? Was the evidence consistent? Did it make biological sense? Did the problem proceed by enough time that it wasn't caused by dementia? If there was an intervention, which as you said, there's now a lot more, did it alleviate it as we would expect it to? And we looked through all of these different types of evidence, and we asked anyone who knew anything else or any other literature to add to it. And then we discussed it. And then at the end of it, I tried to summarise and say, did people just say this? And they said, no, you haven't understood, or yes, you have understood. And they said, no, we kept going until we had 100% consensus as to what things meant. And many of the risk factors that are not in may be risk factors, and we've talked about them in some detail. It's just the evidence isn't quite there yet. It's not consistent or strong enough. And I sort of play a game with myself now that at the end of it, or just after it's all been presented, I think which risk factors might be in the next one, and I'm consistently wrong.
But it's a good thing that some of the authors of the most influential papers on, for instance, sleep and so on, are members of the commission. Yeah. So in a way, they are there to tell about and defend their papers. But also, I think it's important that in this process, we have to rely on not the highest level of evidence, because that's impossible. You can't have a randomized controlled trial, some exposure that happens 20 years before the outcome. So we have to look at observational data and then see if many different studies goes in the same direction, and whether there also is a mechanistic, in a way, explanation of this association, which is a kind of a jigsaw puzzle, and really important in this, have this thorough consensus process.
I was going to say, because it must be so difficult to untangle causality from what you're looking at.
I think it is hard, and that's why we are so... So if we look at sleep as an example, nearly all of the studies in sleep are in the few years before people develop dementia. And dementia, as people are developing it, their sleep gets worse. It's extremely difficult to disentangle causality. Is a sleep causing the dementia, or the dementia causing the sleep? I think it's becoming clearer, but I don't think it's clear yet. We also felt that since the study said that both long and short sleep were associated with dementia, that's not biologically plausible. It suggests that it's sleep disturbance rather than a cause. But then if we looked at social contact, which my colleague Andrew Summerlad sort of started looking at nearly 10 years ago now, we weren't sure whether as people developed dementia, they didn't have social contact, or whether people who had less social contact were more likely to develop dementia. And so looking at longitudinal studies and looking backwards and forwards in groups of data, what we found is that people don't have less social contact as they develop dementia. It's not causative. What happens is they have different social contact. What happens is that as they develop dementia, they see more of their families and fewer friends, but they have the same amount of social contact. But people who have less social contact in their 40s, 50s and 60s are more likely to develop dementia. And that gave us a much clearer idea of causality. And then going back to these studies, more and more of them are doing things, they're doing quasi-experimental things, areas, for example, where pollution is reduced. And we find that that affects cognition and dementia. And that means that makes it very much more likely. So these are the sorts of things we look, but it is difficult, and it's becoming, but all the time there's more and more evidence and things are becoming much, much clearer. And the hope for the future that we really can do a huge amount about things is becoming, I think, much, much better.
I think this is a very important point, because as we know now, the changes in the brain in Alzheimer's disease starts 20 years before you start losing your memory. So at what stage are these changes impacting on the risk factors? That's very difficult. Now with the new blood-based biomarkers, I think researchers will be able to follow the development in the brain in association with the development of risk factors, which can inform this field immensely in the future. So when does this amyloid, beta amyloid, start building up in the brain, and when is the risk factors being measured? I think that will be immensely. And as a matter of fact, we are doing this in the HUD study now.
So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about these biomarkers and kind of what's changed since the last update then.
I think this is potentially a game changer for the diagnostic process in dementia. But there are a lot of challenges, ethical challenges, and in terms of resource. But I live in Norway with a lot of people living in remote areas, the long distance to hospitals. And if they were to receive a biologically confirmed diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, they would have to go to a hospital to have a spinal puncture or an amyloid PET scan. Maybe next year they can go to their general practitioner and get a result with a precision which is as high as done by a spinal puncture or an amyloid PET scan. There's a lot of things we don't know about this yet, but I think this is maybe as important as the new disease-modifying therapies, that, you know, a precise analysis will be available to a lot more people around the world, I would say.
I agree about that, but I'd like to say a caveat that I think for people who have dementia, I mean, I just think that by the time, if we do another Lancet commission, nobody will be doing CSF or amyloid. I think that it will be blood. I mean, the biomarkers, it isn't quite there yet, but it's so consistent, the message about how good it is, how good certain markers are at picking up. So I think that that's what will be happening. But we shouldn't be scanning, we shouldn't be testing the whole population without dementia, because many, many people have a positive amyloid biomarker and never develop dementia. The majority of people with a positive amyloid biomarker, and that gets more and more as we get older, never develop dementia. So it's very important for people who do have dementia, but for those people who don't, we should be extremely careful about it. And only if you were to consider treatment, it would only be treatment in the form of a trial. But as Geir says it, I mean, the looking at amyloid in people's brains and seeing about things, about what difference can be made to that by changing your lifestyle is very interesting. Maybe not very much, because it's not just the, it's not just amyloid, it's how resilient your brain is. And quite a lot of these biomarkers are probably more to do with developing a resilient brain or cognitive reserve or not getting vascular damage rather than changing plaques and tangles.
Yeah, we should remember that this is about Alzheimer's disease. Still, 40% of those who get dementia, they get it from because of another disease. And when it comes to Parkinson-related dementia, so Lewy body dementia, so frontotemporal lobe dementia, we are not there yet. But as Jill said, there are really a few ethical challenges around this. Also, I think, even though we can say to a person that you have amyloid or Alzheimer's changes in your brain 5 years before they start losing the memory, would they want to know it?
Yeah.
If there is no treatment or disease-modifying treatment available, would they really want to know it?
Yeah,
absolutely. And that they might not. I mean, there's the other thing. It's not like we can say, because if we could say it'll happen in 5 years, and the thing to do is take all these trips you've been delaying, do your bucket list, make sure you've got power of attorney and your will sorted out, then that would be one thing. But most of them won't develop dementia, and that makes it much more problematic, ethically.
Mm-hmm. And is there a world in which we try and navigate some of these ethical issues, but actually, you know, this risk factor aspect becomes therefore much more relevant if you're saying, I mean, obviously, this probably wouldn't meet a screening criteria in terms of, you know, the kind of risk benefit and the cost effectiveness, but where people are monitoring some of these things and modifying their lifestyle to try and mitigate any increased risk that they may or may not have.
It might make a difference. You know, telling people to live a healthy life doesn't usually have very much effect. So knowing that they might be at more particular risk might have more. Interestingly, the studies, and there's not many now, seem to indicate that people really don't want to get dementia, and saying to them, this makes you more likely to get dementia, and this could be changed, seems to make more of a difference. It might help, but like Geir said, lots of people who get dementia don't have Alzheimer's disease, so it's a very imprecise way of looking at it. Yeah, I mean, I think people will have to do the tests and see. If you know you've got amyloid in your brain, are you more likely to make these changes, or are you less likely to because you despair? And what happens? Because in one of the young onset dementias, where people have a gene, they were much more likely to engage in self-destructive behaviour because they thought, well, I'm not going to live very long. Why keep my health? And we never quite know what's going to happen until we try it.
I think we have to be aware of how we put this message through, because when I come home to my wife after being in media, talking about what you should do and what you should not do, she says to me that, aren't you realizing that you are just creating fear, anxiety, maybe increasing depression, and at worst, also more stigma? I have to acknowledge that it could be something true in that, because if you're not able to follow these advices, you might have this feeling of shortcomings or increasing anxiety and so on. And in the end, you could say that, well, it's not straight that I got dementia. I did all the bad things in a way. So I think it's important that we think about how we phrase this message.
And maybe we could kind of talk a bit about the treatment landscape, which has also changed. It's a fairly controversial topic, or there seems to be within the community a bit of a divide about the meaningfulness of some of these disease-modifying treatments. It'd be great to hear your perspective and also how it fits into, you know, the Commission's view and sort of afterlife?
So I think we should start off by seeing it's fantastic. Eventually and at last, some of these drugs really seem to be making a difference, and that there is some success, and that that is huge progress and considerable amount of hope. However, it's not a huge amount of change. There are lots of side effects, and it's quite a burdensome and expensive. The drugs are quite expensive and burdensome. So it's only a first step. You have to have first steps in everything. Our mission message is that we should be very open to everyone who's thinking of taking it up about our lack of knowledge, that the change is only small. What we don't know, and I would love to know, is after 18 months or 2 years, are there people who've been on the drugs? Do they do much better and keep going on? Or does that, is there more of a distance between the two drugs? And we really don't know. But I think that the slope of what happens after the first year, when it looks like the lines are pretty much falling in parallel, might suggest it doesn't modify all that much of the disease. But if it does, it's a real game changer. If things go on, and we don't know.
Because we had decades, didn't we, where actually pharmaceutical companies pulled funding from this area. They weren't willing to invest in new drugs. And now at least there's some excitement in this area, and presumably funding interest from big pharma companies will follow that. And we need that, right, to be able to develop new medications.
Absolutely. And, you know, at least, instead of thinking it's an impossible problem, it's just a difficult problem. You know, if a drug really made a big difference, then obviously from pharma's point of view, not only would it be good for society, but it would be good for the pharma company.
But I'm sure that this is the most controversial part of the commission. It was in the discussions in the commission, and it will be, because a lot of people say, why are you so boring, so negative in a way? But I think on this topic, I think the commission is really balanced and expectant. But there might be other research being published even during the conference, which in a way changes this picture. So this is really a field in development. The other thing I'm a bit afraid about is that this focus on monoclonal antibodies removes the focus from other possible agents like tau protein and so on. So I hope in the future that we will be able to use what we now learn about monoclonal antibodies in association with other possible ways of treating dementia.
We don't want to become sort of tunnel visioned over one particular intervention. We need the whole spectrum of advances.
We do, but the proof of concept, if one thing can make a difference, and it's made a difference in more than one trial, things might be able to make a difference. But, you know, even in people with pure Alzheimer's, and that's relatively rare, lots of people have other things, there's more than amyloid plaques. So, you know, it needs to be wider. What we know, we've tried to be honest, we've tried to balance everything within the commission and explain exactly what we know, but what we know next week or next year or in 5 years might be really quite different. Like Gare said, it's very different from 4 years ago, what we know.
I wanted to ask, actually, because we've been talking about treatments and diagnosis, improved diagnosis, but what actually is the current global landscape of dementia, especially thinking about kind of trends over the last 4 years? What does dementia currently look like in low and middle income countries, for example?
There's more and more of it around, I suppose, is the big news. That I think people think that it's a high income country problem. Well, 60% of the people with dementia at the moment are living in low and middle income countries. It's expected to be 2/3 quite soon. It's a huge problem in these countries. It's a problem which few countries have thought about, have had the resources and the tradition to think about in great detail, although more and more of them are. So I think that's really important. And you know, this is not just sort of rich white people. It's poor people that have more of the problem, both within high-income countries and out with high-income countries, it's an illness which happens more to people who have less.
And I think one of the changes comparing with the previous commissions is that people representing low and middle income countries and having knowledge about research in these countries and also the clinical reality are better represented in the commission. So in a way, you might say that the commission is more diverse in terms of ethnical background, in terms of interdisciplinary experts and so on, which I think is a huge progress and important for the Lancet Commission. And when we discuss this, things that seem evident, as you remember, we said that the cholinesterase inhibitors, they are affordable, they're easily accessible. And then somebody told us, no, they're not affordable, they're not easily accessible in many low and middle income countries. So it's been a huge advantage to have these people directing, in a way, the output from it.
And going back to stigma, dementia still has stigma throughout the world, but that is often more so in low and middle income countries, in particular countries where either for some countries it's huge stigma, and in other places, many people think, they still think that in high income countries, but even more so, that it's a sort of inevitable thing that happens when you age and everybody develops dementia, but they don't. Most people don't develop dementia, and dementia is an illness, and it's not an illness to be ashamed of. It's an illness, and you, any more than you would be than you're ashamed of developing diabetes or cancer. It's one of the things that happens to people, and more of it happens the older you are.
Over the next few years, I think, Jill, earlier you said that it was basically impossible to predict what might go into the next commission update. But, you know, if you were going to make a prediction, what might you go for?
I'm hoping and predicting there will be more and better drugs. And I'm hoping and predicting that governments around the world will be doing a lot more to prevent dementia. They will look at the economics as well as the social impact of preventing dementia and see that it's a no-brainer. One of my friends called it the dementia bonus. You know, if we do these things and many fewer people have dementia, given that and we have a compaction of morbidity, which is we didn't know about before, but what happens is that even when people develop it, they develop it later and live fewer years with it. So they live till they're older, but for fewer years with having dementia. That saves an enormous amount of money, an enormous amount of social stress. So my prediction is in 4 years' time that many, many governments will be working on this and trying to prevent as many people as having dementia as possible so that they can spend less on illness and have more of an older workforce. It makes economic as well as social sense.
I hope, as you, but I'm not sure that politicians will think that way. It's not easy for a politician to advocate for prevention strategies, which only pays off in 20 or 30 years' time, in a way. So I think this has to become top-down, in a way, also. It's important that the World Health Organization keeps up the pressure, I think, about prevention strategies. And I also hope for the future that we will have an even greater emphasis on initiatives to improve lives for people who have dementia today. Because no matter how much progress is made in prevention or treatment, there will still in the future be more people who have dementia. Much or most of the research is now on prevention, on diagnosis, and on treatment, but really also need very good research on how to improve quality of life for those people who have dementia and their caregivers.
That's great. Jill, Keir, thank you both so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been a really fascinating and insightful chat, and we really appreciate your time.
Thank you for inviting us. It's been a pleasure to chat.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a lovely conversation. Really great to have your perspectives on this.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Lancet Voice. And remember, you can subscribe to The Lancet Voice wherever you usually get your podcasts. We'll see you again back here next time.